This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Kinnaery. Thanks for joining us. Long-form journalism and deep-dive investigative reporting on local issues have always been the domain of local newspapers. But as newsrooms have shrunk, gaps have been created, and a new model for local journalism has emerged in response. Nonprofit newsrooms, mostly comprised of reporters who once worked for newspapers and other forms of commercial media. Examples here in Florida include the Florida Phoenix and the Florida Trident, and about a year ago, Suncoast Searchlight joined the mix with a focus on Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto counties. Suncoast Searchlight's team of reporters and editors include several former Sarasota Herald Tribune staffers, and their board includes NPR's retired Chief Diversity Officer Keith Woods, Poynter Institute Senior Vice President Kelly McBride, and New York Times Deputy Investigations Editor Chris Davis. I spoke on January 8th with their Executive Editor-in-Chief, Emily LaCoste, to get a sense of their origin story and mission and reflect on the state of local news that's led to the rise of these online nonprofit news organizations. Emily LaCoste is Executive Editor-in-Chief of Suncoast Searchlight. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
So for starters, tell us a little bit about your background and what led you up to the point of being Executive Editor-in-Chief at Suncoast Searchlight.
Well, I've had a career in journalism that I started 25 or so years ago. Started out as a general assignment reporter for a small newspaper in the Mississippi Delta and worked my way up, investigative reporter, investigative editor, managing editor, all the way up until USA Today, where I worked for 5 years as part of the investigations team, but based here in Sarasota. And when the opportunity came about to apply for a position to lead a new nonprofit newsroom based in Sarasota and covering Sarasota and our region, I jumped at the opportunity. I love local news and was looking for an opportunity to get back to local news after doing national news for quite a while. And so it's just been great.
So you were part of the origin of Suncoast Searchlight? You were part of the initial team?
Well, yes and no. Suncoast Searchlight's initial launch was a news organization called Community News Collaborative. And Suncoast Searchlight is actually the business name of Community News Collaborative. The Baranczyk Foundation, which is a family foundation based here in Sarasota, had the idea to start a new newsroom to serve our dwindling media market. And so they started a newsroom that operated for about 8 months. They housed it under WUSF through a grant with WUSF. And that iteration was producing some good community news, but not the type of hard-hitting news, I guess, that Baranczyk Foundation really envisioned. And so they folded the newsroom, went back to the drawing board, formed a separate 501c3, and asked some really great folks to serve on a board. That board then hired me. And so I came on board in September of 2024 and worked with the board to draw up the plans for what is this iteration of the newsroom. And so our 501c3 is Community News Collaborative, which is the same name that the previous newsroom had.
Understood. Is the foundation the primary source of funding for you guys as a nonprofit, or how does the funding model work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Baranczyk Foundation provided the seed money in the form of a grant that had several sort of tranches. And so that seed money allowed us to get up and operating and gave us a runway of a couple of years during which time we could sort of do our proof of concept, produce news, and then hit the ground asking for other folks to step up and provide funding, apply for grants. And so our goal is to diversify our revenue stream and wean our alliance of Baranczyk Foundation. You know, we hope that the foundation will continue to support us financially, but it was never their intention to be the sole, revenue source for Suncoast Searchlight.
When I first learned of you guys, I was reminded of the Florida Phoenix and the Florida Trident. Are you, is that you guys are sort of the same thing, journalists from other organizations sort of banding together to do deep dive news?
Yeah, exactly. And we, in fact, partner pretty frequently with Florida Trident. We did a big investigation over the summer with Michael Barfield of Florida Trident looking at Sarasota County's preparations and response to Tropical Storm Debbie, which catastrophically flooded wide swaths of our area. So yeah, it's a similar concept. Nonprofit newsroom staffed by journalists who, for the most part, work for other, you know, news organizations, traditional news organizations, before making the leap to nonprofit news.
You know, here in public radio, we've watched the local newspapers shrink, as you're well aware. You know, our papers down here used to be separate. They used to have hundreds of people on staff. Now they're together and they've got maybe scores, probably dozens of people on staff. What's that been like for you as somebody who's been in the newspaper business to just watch that whole thing? Because it's so important. The smaller the newspapers get, the more important I think people realize they are.
It's been gut-wrenching. This is, you know, when I moved over here to Suncoast Searchlight, that's the first time I've left the newspaper business since my career started. And so, yeah, it's devastating, right? Not just as a journalist, but as somebody who's, you know, a news consumer. You rely on these newspapers to provide you accurate, timely information about things that really matter to you. And at no time was that more evident than during and after the hurricanes. You know, that last year we just got smacked, right, with back-to-back hurricanes, or I guess the year before last, now that we're in 2026. And so, you know, I wanted to go and get news about what is happening, what happened, why did it happen, how did it happen? And it's just really hard for a newspaper with eight people to make sense of all of that versus when the newspaper had 100 plus in the newsroom and they could assemble a team of a dozen reporters to deep dive, you know, the public entity's response to the hurricanes. And I'm talking primarily of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, where I spent several years before USA Today. And at its height, had, I think, 150 people in the newsroom, and now has about eight. You know, they're fantastic journalists. They're doing their best, but there's only so much that eight people can do.
I often think, you know, I've been here at the station for a very long time, and I often think what it must be like for elected officials who can have meetings now and just have no media show up. You know, ones that have been doing it for long enough where they remember when there was always people there from different, you know, TV stations and newspapers, and what that means for transparency in government, you know?
Yeah. No, that's definitely the case. I was just reading a story this morning. So I spent 12 years of my career in Mississippi and still follow the news there. And there's a nonprofit newsroom called Mississippi Today. It's a statewide newsroom. They've been in operation 10 years. In fact, won a Pulitzer a few years ago. But the Speaker of the House in the Mississippi legislature held a invitation-only press briefing and uninvited, or just didn't even invite, a journalist from Mississippi Today, even though they cover the legislature just like, you know, the other traditional print publications do. And that's the type of thing that we're seeing now, is not just the lack of media presence at government meetings, but the government willfully excluding journalists from those meetings. And that's not just happening in Mississippi. Obviously, you see that happening in the nation's capital, where President Trump has, you know, booted the Associated Press from meetings for over its policy to continue referring to the body of water just west of us as the Gulf of Mexico, or the Pentagon booting journalists refusing to sign, you know, its new agreement barring them from publishing stories without its permission. So, yeah, we're seeing a lot of those effects, and government officials and government agencies acting as though the media can be brushed aside, ignored, disregarded.
How big is your team of reporters? And it looks like you and several others do have backgrounds there in Sarasota, but maybe not everybody. Just break down who your reporters are.
So yeah, it's me. I've been in Sarasota for 10 years. Josh Salmon, who's my investigations editor and senior investigations reporter, is a lifelong Sarasotan, and was also at the Sarasota Herald Tribune and the Bradenton Herald and the Charlotte Sun. Derek Gilliam is a longtime Florida resident and reporter, and has been in Sarasota, I think, about 5 years. He's a watchdog investigative reporter. Kara Newhouse comes to us from Washington, D.C. She was born and raised in Pennsylvania, a longtime journalist, and she is our investigative data reporter. So she does a lot of coding and complex data analyses. And then Alice Herman is from Wisconsin. She was working for the Guardian's U.S. publication before coming here to Sarasota to join us at the Searchlight. And then we do rely on freelance reporters as well.
So you guys do watchdog and investigative reporting with a team that size. How do you determine like what you're going to focus on? Because, you know, while you do have the independence and you do have no constraints because you're not printing it on paper, like how do you decide what's the rubric for what you're going to cover?
That's a great question. And I honestly get anxiety thinking about it because there's so much happening in our community right now that I wish I had like triple the staff or quadruple the staff, because there's so much that's happening that deserves watchdog reporting. And I know it's not getting it, but with a team this small, yeah, we have to make some strategic decisions. And so we hold meetings every couple of weeks where we talk about what's happening in our region and what's happening nationally that's impacting our region, and making determinations about, you know, what is a Suncoast Searchlight story? Where do we want to spend our resources? Where might we make the biggest impact by reporting on something? It's, you know, you're in the news business, you know, it's not an exact science. It's subjective, but it's based on our skill set. It's based on conversations that we have with sources and community stakeholders. And we try to make the best decisions we can. I mean, one thing that was not on our radar, you know, 6 months ago, but that we jumped on pretty quickly, was the Schools of Hope legislation when that was passed. And when those charter schools were eyeing some of the public schools within our district, we wanted to report on that. So many of our publications, including the Sarasota Herald Tribune and the Bradenton Herald, don't have dedicated K-12 education reporters. And so that seemed like an area where we could jump in. And that is one of the things that we try to do, is not step on the toes of other media partners here. So if there's a topic that they're covering and covering well, we tend to, you know, not dive in. But if there's an area where nobody's really jumping in and providing coverage, we see that as an opportunity that we can provide value.
I went through and looked at some of your most recent stories, and you know, it's long form reporting. Do you have an understanding of how much people are reading it? Because, you know, people have short attention spans these days, and good reporting sometimes is overwhelming to people with short attention spans, as unfortunate as that is.
Yeah, we do have some long stories. We try not to go over about 3,000 words, which even that sounds long, I concede. But yeah, we've actually got really good metrics on our website. We have an average, oh gosh, I don't remember what it is off the top of my head, but most of our stories get, you know, 1,500, 2,000 page views. And that's, you know, considering the fact that most of our stories are also picked up by other media outlets. And so there's countless eyeballs on our stories that we never even track because they're not through our website. And engagement time on our stories are, you know, 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute, 4 minutes sometimes. And so, yeah, we feel like readers are engaging with our work and they're appreciative of what we do. Obviously, we try to write our stories in a way that even if you only have the attention span for, you know, 1 minute, you know, you're getting the gist of the story in that time.
I would like to take a moment to reintroduce my guest. Emily Lacaze is executive editor-in-chief of the nonprofit investigative news outfit Suncoast Searchlight. It was founded in February of 2025 on the belief that a strong independent press is essential to a thriving community. They focus on stories in and around Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto counties, so up in the northern end of our listening area. Emily was most recently with USA Today, where she spent 5 years as an investigative reporter and editor. She also previously served as deputy investigations editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. If you'd like to engage with the show about this topic or any of our episodes, please use our social media. Just look up WGCU on Instagram and Facebook. So you recently created a formal AI policy, which stems from a situation last November, and I would like you to kind of explain what unfolded there.
Sure. Staff in the newsroom has had raised concerns about the use of AI and the fact that we did not have a clear AI policy. And so we got together with the staff and with the help of our board member, Kelly McBride, with the Poynter Institute, and had a robust discussion about how the staff already was using AI. Many of us were, and we're doing it in ways that we all personally felt comfortable with, but we're not necessarily telling each other, hey, I'm using this tool to do this, or I'm using that tool to do that. And so that ambiguity, had raised some alarm bells within the newsroom, but we wanted to address it head on. And so after that discussion with Kelly, went through and came up with an AI policy based on a template that Poynter Institute has for this exact purpose, and came up with an AI policy governing both editorial use of those tools as well as non-editorial use of those tools. And we implemented that by the end of the year. So I think December 23rd is when we finalized that policy, and also assembled an AI committee. On our team, we've got three reporters who are on that committee, and they meet monthly or will be meeting monthly to, constantly evaluate our team's use of those tools, evaluate how AI is being used throughout the industry, and update those guidelines as needed.
I read a story on Neiman Lab, which broke down some details, and it appears that there was a reporter among those who raised concerns that was let go by you guys. What's the story with that?
Well, unfortunately, there's not much I can say about that. It's a personnel issue, as I'm sure you can understand. And all I can say is I confirm that a reporter was let go.
I read through your AI policy and it's very comprehensive, and we don't have one here at the station yet, and it's something that we're working on. One of your board members, as you mentioned, is with Poynter. It's a brave new world. There's ups and downs to AI, and especially with journalism. How do you feel about the new policy, and have you had a chance yet to, use it, if that makes sense? Give us some of the details of like what it is. It goes into great detail about what systems, what language models you can use, when you can use it, how you have to have humans do verification. Just give us a bit of a detail on what the AI policy covers.
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's a pretty robust policy. Again, lots of credit to Kelly McBride and the Poynter Institute for having come up with a template. The policy it talks about the certain tools that we use, that we can use, and the ways in which we can use those tools. So, for example, we can use those tools for initial research. For finding articles and sources, for helping us write code that we might use to, say, scrape a website or analyze data. We can use it for copy editing, for example, to, say, go through this story and, flag AP style violations, for example, to summarize documents. And these, by the way, are uses that are pretty consistent across a lot of newsrooms, whether they've been codified in a policy or not, that I know from talking to other journalists, that I know from going to journalism conferences, these sort of like online trainings that you can go to for journalists. So yeah, AI is being used and sort of philosophy of the newsroom that we need to be using it as well, or we're going to be left behind. And so let's set out some ground rules to make sure that we're all using it in a way that we're all transparent about, that we all agree on, and that we can, kind of monitor and update as we go. But yeah, I think that the crux of it is, if you want to boil it down into its essential elements, yeah, we want to use it in a way that's responsible. If we're using it in a way that significantly alters our stories, we're going to disclose that. If it's something that, hey, we ran a story that we were right before we published to flag typos, that's not necessarily something that needs to be disclosed to the readers. But if a portion of the story was generated, from analysis that ChatGPT helped with or Notebook LM helped with, right? Like those are the types of things that we would disclose.
You know, it's interesting because I've learned I use it to help me kind of hone in on certain topics or, you know, if I come across a word I don't know how to use, I can bounce back and forth. But the human verification thing is very important because sometimes it will kind of make things up. But the interesting thing is that, you know, in the audio world that we live in, we've added tools over the years to make audio sound better. And at first, we had to really be careful. Eventually, you get to a place where you just trust it. And I just wonder if we'll ever get there with these kinds of generative AI tools, or if we're always going to be looking over our shoulder with using them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's, I really don't know. And it might be something that, you know, I don't know how old you are, but maybe our generation never fully trusts it, but the generation after us that maybe grew up with it might.
We've only got a couple minutes left. You guys also provide resources like helping people with FOIA requests and stuff like that. Tell us just a little bit about that aspect of your mission.
Yeah. So our mission isn't just, hey, we're going to produce a bunch of great content and make it available for free for other outlets to pick up. But we also collaborate with other media outlets. We, as I mentioned, you know, we've done a joint investigation with Florida Trident. We've done several investigations with Bradenton Herald. But we also, yeah, we'll provide editing services. We'll provide data services, public record services for newsrooms that might be pursuing their own stories independent of us, but could use a little assist. And since we do have those specialized people on staff, like I mentioned, Kara Newhouse, our investigative data reporter, who's, you know, got a master's in data journalism and can do some pretty in-depth coding. Right. Like those are some of the things, because we have that specialization, we're happy to work with other newsrooms to help them further their own projects.
And you guys explicitly offer up your content for other organizations, I guess, with citation that it comes from you. I mean, is that for anybody? Is that just for nonprofit news organizations? Like, how does that work in terms of other outlets disseminating your stories?
It's for anybody. That includes Substack. That includes nonprofit newsrooms. It includes for-profit newsrooms, print, radio, digital, TV, you name it. Because part of our mission is to support the entire media ecosystem. You know, we were not created to compete. We were created to complement and to enhance. And so that's really foundational to our mission. And we consider other media organizations in our community as our friends and partners. And so, yep. We have a Creative Commons license. It says you can use anything you want. Just please don't change it. And please cite us.
Do you partner with any public radio stations or have any public radio stations helped disseminate any of your content? Have we? I am unaware of the answer to that question.
WUSF routinely publishes our work. WSLR, we actually turn our stories into radio scripts for them. And then our reporters read those scripts and provide the recordings to them. And then we also, yeah, WGCU also, runs our stuff. I email Michael Braun every week or so. We've got a lot of partners in the public radio domain.
Can you imagine, and this is an unfair question, but I have to ask as somebody who's been doing this for a long time, can you imagine local newspapers somehow turning around and filling these kinds of reporting niches again someday? Or is that just a ship that sailed that we'll just look back on?
I don't know. I really lament what we have lost and wish we could return to the days where we had beat reporters covering everything and newsrooms were robust and we would even compete against each other. I don't know if that'll ever happen again. I sure hope it does.
This is kind of a silly example, but I use this as an example to help younger people understand. Our Fort Myers News Press used to have reporters at every high school football game collecting the numbers. And now this seems crazy now, but that's how robust the local papers once were. And it's a shame that we don't have that anymore.
I know. I remember those days too. And it's really sad. I in the 90s, when I was going to J school, I had a part-time job as the night news clerk at the St. Paul Pioneer Press. And I worked from 3 to 11 o'clock. And even at 11 o'clock, the newsroom was bustling. You know, everybody on the copy desk was there. There was, you know, the night news editor and a few night news reporters. The scanner was going all the time. I mean, it was, you couldn't walk into the newsroom at 2 o'clock and it'd be empty. I mean, it was always, there was always a presence. And I really miss those days.
Well, we look forward to, you know, helping you get your word out and, you know, helping our community, even the northern end of our listening area, better understand what's happening around them, because that's what we're here for. But that's all the time we have. Thanks to my guest, Emily Lacaze, is Executive Editor-in-Chief of Suncoast Searchlight. Thank you so much for your time, Emily.
Thank you so much.
You can find a link to the Suncoast Searchlight website to see the kind of work they do on our website, wgcu.org/GCL. If you missed any of the show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, or you can subscribe to Gulf Coast Life as a podcast. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Conniry. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM. We are NPR for Southwest Florida.